You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. It's been 23 long hours, but our long national nightmare is over now, and Connecting the Dots is back on the air. So happy to be here. And you're listening to not only me and my dulcet tones, but you will also soon, in just one moment, be hearing the voice of Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett, author of Four Witnesses. Rod Bennett, author of The Apostasy That Wasn't. Rod Bennett, author of The Christus Experiment, former editor of Wonder Magazine, all-around swell guy, raconteur, and everybody's favorite Dutch uncle.
It's good to be back, Mark.
Good to be back. How's it going?
Very, very well indeed. Thank you.
Good.
Yeah, buried in my writing right now. That's okay. I need to be inside anyway. It's cold outside.
That's appropriate. Yeah, it's cold here, too. It was 27 degrees last night. Well, and thereby hangs a tale.
Really?
Yes. So, week before last, right about this time, actually, I was minding my own business. The phone rings, and it's this company that's offering this great deal. They're going to come out, and we have forced air heating in our house. So living as we do in the Pacific Northwest, we have a colossal hydroelectric grid, thanks to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said,
yep,
"Why
that's something we have in common, Mark. I live in TVA country, so."
That's right, and I live in the Bonneville Power Administration country out here. So they dammed up the Columbia River about, you know, every 10 miles or something. They put up a new dam on the Columbia River and dammed the whole thing up and turned Washington into this gigantic exporter of hydroelectric power. And also, by the way, turned the Columbia River Valley into this immensely fruitful fruit basket. So if you've ever heard of Grand Coulee Dam, that's here in Washington.
Yep.
And so anyway, cheap electrical power. So we have in our house. Our house was built in 1950. Good post-war cinder block house. And we moved into this house in 1992. And whoever lived in this house had at some undefined point in the now remote past had put in forced air heating, electrical forced air heating, not gas. And so it's got five air ducts that run through the house. And so we get this call from this company that says, "We'll come and clean your air ducts for $40, they said. I said, "Wow, $40, that's a tank of gas. I just got to sell a couple of my books and I can pay for this. Okay, come and clean my air ducts. I'm happy to let you do that because it's been like forever since we've done that." And so the guys come out and they're these two kind of burly, intimidating guys, you know, from some country that ends with Stan.
This is so funny because have you ever seen the movie Brazil? Terry Gilliam movie.
Oh, okay, yeah.
They send guys out to clean the ducks, and they send these two somewhat creepy, quasi foreign guys. So ever since you mentioned the ducks, I thought of do your ducks seem old fashioned? But anyway,
I haven't really looked at my ducks.
If you haven't seen the movie, this doesn't mean it aren't
anyway,
to anybody. So go on with your story.
So these guys come out, and they open our little kind of cubby hidey hole where the forced air heating, what do you call it? Engine.
Gizmo
is ensconced, and they go, and they shake their head.
This is bad. This is bad,
they say. So I'm going, what? And they go, and I know that this thing, I mean, just to look at it, it just looks like Soviet-era technology. I mean, it's just, I know it's old, right? And so I'm going, yeah. And we've never, you know, we've just never been able to afford to get it clean. So we cleaned the filter now and then, but the rest of it was, so it's like covered in dust and all this stuff. And they're going, you know, there's no point in cleaning air ducts if we do not clean air blower. And we're I'm going, you know, okay, you know, what's that going to cost me? So they punch up the numbers on their little, you know, Samsung or something.
Ultimately, of course, they're wanting to sell you a $2,000 furnace.
Well, in this case, they go, will cost $960.
Okay.
I'm going, and so my wife is going, $40. I knew they were going to do this. This is bait and switch and all the rest of it. So, you know, we're looking at Christmas and we got all these other expenses and all this stuff going on. And, you know, so Jan's going, let's just skip this right now. So they like immediately go, well, we will drop price to $750. And I'm going, man, this is looking shadier all the time, you know. But at the same time, you know, I know perfectly well that it's true that this thing does, in fact, need maintenance, that it's ancient. It was here when we bought the house, and I think it was old by then, you know. So I'm going, well, we got to do something about this thing sooner or later, and it's probably going to cost this much no matter what. So finally I go, all right, we'll bite the bullet. You dropped the price $200 already. I don't think I'm going to get other deals that are going to be all that much better. So, all right, clean the thing. So that's what they did. So I go back to work, and I'm sitting here at my computer working and stuff, and they're doing whatever it is they do to make the thing go and to clean the ducts and everything. And so we finish up, and I pay them the... You know, I write the check and they leave. And then I look, because I'm stupid. Then I look at the bill of sale. And all of a sudden, suddenly I realize that $40 duct cleaning that I initially had them in for, the price of that magically went up to $300. So I'm like, wait a minute. I thought I was getting the heater cleaned plus the ducts, and the heat and the extra expense was for the cleaning of the heater. And then they were going to tack the $40 on for the duct cleaning. No, we jerked you around and surprised you with this it's deep cleaning, right? Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert on duct cleaning, you know, you just said you were going to clean my ducts. So anyway, by this time they're gone. I've already paid them. And so I call the company and say, what's this $300 duct cleaning thing? I had them out to clean my ducts for $40. Where's this extra $260 charge coming from? And, well, didn't they explain that to you? Nobody said anything to me. They said they were going to clean the heater and they were going to clean the ducts. And because of the heater cleaning, I thought that was where all this extra cost came from. Well, it turned out, they hadn't explained that. Oh, really? Well, you know, we'll send them back and you can work this out with them, right? Okay, fine. So they come back and these guys are just absolutely surly and confrontational and accusatory, and they're calling me a cheat and all the rest of it, you know? And I'm going, wait a minute, you know? You guys jerked me out of $260 and you're accusing me? So any like momentary sense of, well, you know, they did all this extra work, so maybe I should, you know, let them have their $300. That vanished out the window, right? I was like, nobody made clear to me that there was going to be some difference in the duct cleaning. If I'd known that, I would not have asked them to do it. So anyway, after they were finished just being nasty and abusive and confrontational and accusatory, they finally tore up the check in disgust and tore up the bill of sale in disgust. And I wrote them a new check. They dropped the price down to $591 for all this work. Okay, good. You're they're gone. I don't ever have to think about these jerks again. And that's that. So 5 days pass. And last night I'm sitting here working, and you can hear, when it's blowing, I can hear the blower, you know, coming through the air duct directly over my head as I'm sitting here working.
Right.
So it starts all of a sudden making this rattling noise that it's never, ever made before.
Well, the dust was the only thing holding it together.
Yes. I'm like, that's not good. And so when it shuts down, it makes this really disquieting noise as it shuts down.
Uh-huh.
And it's about like 11 o'clock last night. And the temperature's already down to 27 degrees outside. And I'm thinking, uh-oh. And so like an hour goes by. And then the temperature in the room drops enough that it starts up again. And when it starts up, it just makes this hideous squealing sound. Just terrifying, awful squealing sound, and then finally just goes and dies. And there's this awful strangling noise, and then all you can hear is just the motor going, trying real hard to go, but it can't budge. So we shut it all off. But the system is such that it won't work. Or it won't shut off like instantly. It takes like 30 seconds before the motor shuts off after you've turned the thermostat down.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I will continue this saga when we return. You're listening to Connected to Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our co-host today is Rod Bennett. And we'll be back finishing the epic saga of the heater. And then we're going to be talking about Mary, Did You Know? And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett telling the saga of the heating system. So I look at the bill and I realize, wait a minute, what's this $300 thing? So I get my money back on the $300 vent cleaning that I had no idea I was being charged for until after it was all done. And they go away, and I figure everything is fine. And then last night, the heating system like dies. It gives this hideous death scream and then dies. And so now I'm like super not happy with these guys. So I get up in the morning and, I
pretty
put
cold,
up
I would imagine, in the house in the morning.
It was down to about 60 degrees. So it says something about our double pane windows and the insulation in our attic that there's still enough of a heat bubble inside the house that even though it's 27 degrees outside, still 60 degrees inside when the heat hasn't run all night. So I'm happy about that. Plus, of course, sharing a bed with my beloved, we both act as big hot water bottles for one another. That works, too. So anyway, so I get up in the morning and I call the public utility district and say, who can I talk to about, repair or replacing the thing? And they report me. They give me a list of people that I can contact. So I contact a couple of those guys, and the first guys can't come until tomorrow. And I'm thinking it's going to be really cold in here. So I call the next guy, and they can come today. And meanwhile, I'm still waiting until 9 o'clock to call the people who screwed up my heater last week and say, I want all my money back, except for your stupid $40. And so they say, So I talked to the secretary, and I explained to her all of this that had happened and all the abuse and hostility that I'd gotten from their work stuff. And she's just like, oh, really sorry. So she talks to, like, whoever the boss of the company is. And he comes on the phone, and he also sounds like he's from some country ending with Stan, but he's super nice and just falling all over himself to apologize, and really a good guy. You could tell that he was humiliated by my experience and was not at all happy with these guys. Okay. So I say, look, all I want at this point is, you know, if you... do you have any people there? And I don't want those guys. I'd never want to see those guys again. But is there anybody that can, at your company, that fixes these things, or do you just clean them and do stuff? Oh, no, we can do repairs. And, you know, believe me, I'm going to have somebody out there. Well, it turns out they contract out to a bunch of different people, including these guys from something called Northwest Energy Conservation, who it's a reputable company that I've heard of in the area. So the air, what is it? Eco Air Elite, that was the company that helped me out here, says, we will get somebody out to your house today free of charge. You don't have to pay anything. We're really sorry about this. I'm going to see to it that everything is taken care of, and it'll all be on my dime. So these guys come out to our house this morning, and they're just super nice guys. And they come in, and they're really helpful. And they go in, and it turns out literally the guys who had initially done the cleaning had, just like in the movies, they had literally left a screw loose in the air conditioner, and it worked its way out over the course of a week, and then fallen down inside of the, you know, the whirling fan blades or something, and wedged in there. And that was the hideous scream that I heard was this screw. So anyway, they said, we figured it out. There's So here you go. They get it all fixed and everything, and they turn it on. It all comes on just the way it's supposed to, and I'm super happy and great. And so thank you so much. And they leave, and they drive away, and then I go over to the thermostat, and I set the thermostat to 70 degrees. Now, the temperature in the house is like 60 degrees. So I set the thermostat to 70 degrees. It was running before. And nothing happens. I can't believe it. So I crank the thermostat all the way up, as high as it will go, and then the heater comes on and starts going. So I'm going, okay, well, maybe there's just, you know, a little problem with it. So I start turning the thermostat back down to 70 degrees, and it shuts off. And it's still like 60 degrees in the house. I'm going, can't stand it. Now the thermostat, now we have to have it cranked up to like 100 degrees for it to come on. I'm going, I can't believe this. So just as this happens, there's a knock at the door, because one of the companies that I'd contacted before I contacted Eco Air Elite, either I forgot to call them and say don't come, or they hadn't gotten the message. I'm not really sure which. So there's these two guys standing on my doorstep, and they go, we're here to fix your furnace. I said, well, actually, the furnace is already fixed. And so thanks, it's taken care of. They go, okay, and they start to leave. And I close the door, and then I think, what am I doing? So I open the door. Wait a minute, you guys. So what's going on with my thermostat? Because up until yesterday, my thermostat worked reasonably well. Well, it could be your heat anticipation strip, they say. I'm going, well, let me ask you this. If the blades got jammed yesterday, and so the motor was trying to work, but the thing wasn't working, could it possibly have somehow screwed up my thermostat? They say, yeah, actually, that is possible. Of course, it could also be a coincidence, they say, but it's also possible. And I'm going, okay, I'm not going to hold you to that. However, I'm going to go ahead and say it was not a coincidence, because it sure doesn't feel like a coincidence to me. So they leave, didn't have any charge from them. And then I call the company back, the Eco Air Elite guys, and say, my thermostat seems to have fried out at exactly the moment that the heating unit fried out yesterday. And the guy, once again, the guy is like super apologetic, you know. He's like, "Don't worry about it. We will also replace your thermostat. We're not going to charge you anything." And so, the long and the short of it is, in the God writes straight with crooked lines story of the Shea heating system, it looks like we got a complete fix and a new thermostat on our heating system for our money's worth. So I'm happy.
Well, good. I'm glad.
Everything
it's
is
just the joys of the happy homeowner. These things happen.
Yes, yes. So God has provided in this bitter cold winter, and we have not gone without heat for more than 12 hours. So I'm a happy person.
I'm glad to hear about it, buddy.
It's cold out there. So there you go. God provides, and all is well. Or at least God will provide when we actually have the new thermostat, which should be coming soon. And anyway.
That's good. Now the show can go on because you're not frozen out of your house. I was worried we wouldn't even do the show today. But
I had I actually had people saying, "You can come and stay at our house until you get some heat." So these are good friends of mine, so I can kid around with them. So I said, "Why, thank you. Be aware.
I'll be over in 20 minutes."
I said, "That sounds great. I like my eggs over easy, delivered promptly to me at 8 a.m. "We're a full service operation." I said, "Excellent." And somebody else wrote in and said, "Would you like me to bring you some liquor so that you can cope with him?" I said, "Yes." I said, I like Irish cream, especially the really expensive kind.
Oh boy!
So we had a jolly time, but God is good. And I have good friends. Just all these lovely, kind people, you know, wrote in to pray for us,
you really had a wonderful life.
I've really had a wonderful life. Now making a sharp right turn from there. We thought we might spend a little time and talk about a popular song that always shows up at Christmas time called "Mary, Did You Know?" This is a song that generates controversy.
Last week we had to take down the area of Nicholas Slaps Arias meme around, and now we've had a week to stew on all of these "Mary, Did You Know?" memes.
"Mary, Did You Know?" Well, and you know, the thing is that I wrote as a kind of a gag last year. I wrote something for my blog called "Mary, Did You Know? Frequently Asked Questions."
I remember that.
Because the whole song is this sort of question, you know, every verse is a question line. "Mary, did you know that your baby boy would one day walk on water? And did you know this? And did you know that?" And for some reason, people thought that that article was like just a huge slap at that song. And I didn't really intend it to be a slap at the song. It just seemed like a kind of a fun framework for talking about some of these questions. We'll be back on Connecting the Dots right after this. You're listening to me and Rod Bennett. I'm Mark Shea, and my co-host is Rod Bennett. We'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. Thought we'd take a little bit of time and talk about the song Mary, Did You Know? Because there's a lot packed into that song. And I think that there's some very positive things that can be said about this song. A lot of times Catholics get irked by it, but I think there's some very positive things that can be said about it. And Rod, you wanted to talk about it as well.
Well, coming at it from a non-Catholic perspective, because when the song came out, I think the first time I heard it was about 1998, something like that. I had been a Catholic for about 2 years, so. Mm-hmm. The evangelical perspective on things was pretty fresh in my mind at the moment. And I remember hearing that song and being struck very forcibly by how unusually Marian it was for an evangelical
exactly.
song. In mm-hmm. other words, it was something you didn't really hear.
Right.
Not just was it a song. I mean, you hear songs about, you know, about the manger scene and Mary's where she's supposed to be, but,
right.
But this was a meditation mm-hmm. on really, it's a meditation really, if you think about it, on the Theotokos, Mother of God.
Right.
You know, it's talking about, did you know that the child that you've just given birth to is the great I Am? That's mm-hmm. a pretty staggering idea. And for evangelicals, you're getting darn close to Mother of God at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
the essential idea is there. And so at the time that I first heard the song, I went, wow, this represents some kind of breach in the dike, you know, mm-hmm. some kind of a somebody has sat around and thought about this a little more than you're really supposed to in those circles.
In evangelical circles.
Sort of fumbled
exactly
their way
right.
into, they reinvented the wheel here, you know.
Yeah. Which is, now, you know, it's one of the the marks of evangelicalism at its best is that evangelicalism at its best is interest. It wants reality. And so what happens is if you pursue reality, sooner or later, you're going to bump into Catholic theology because Catholic theology exists to describe reality.
Right. Yeah.
And you get, you know, I've seen this happen in the past. I've had evangelicals who... Yeah, my wife once talked to a woman who was talking about how at her little non-denom church, they were starting to look at the lives of Christians who lived after the time of the Bible to see how they lived as disciples. And as long as my wife didn't use Catholic jargon like cult of the saints, that conversation went off famously.
Right.
You know,
reinventing the wheel is probably a good way to put it because they
exactly
are
right.
interacting with the Bible. In a way that's fairly similar with what the early church fathers did in the first few centuries. And because they're discounting or never heard or not listening to, you know, the 1800 years of accumulated wisdom that the Catholic Church is the guardian of,
right.
you know, it's still, you know, they're still partying like it's $2.99, you know. And coming up with things like this. So this is the reason why the song is a defective piece of Mariology from a Catholic perspective.
Sure.
Because it's totally unaware of 1,800 years of development.
Right.
But it's somewhat analogous to the defective theological statements you find in many of the early fathers on subjects like the Trinity and the natures of Christ and things like that. It's defective not because somebody's resisting truth, but because they're sort of fumbling in the dark toward it, if you see what
right.
I'm saying.
Yes, exactly right.
And so the thing has always been interesting to me, but then it's also, in recent years, it's gotten a lot of blowback from Catholics who seem to take a lot of joy in shooting it down. And I think probably what's going on there is they have started playing it in Catholic churches from time to time.
Right.
And I think that really is a bit of a problem.
Yeah, you shouldn't do that because it is from a Catholic perspective, the theology is defective.
Yeah, at the very least you would, you know, it's like reading some of these early statements from the fathers that don't take later thinking into account. You can't just let them stand on their own.
Right, right.
It was something that
because the fathers are feeling their way along.
Right,
too.
Right, right. But at any rate, the song is interesting. It's not really, you know, the memes that go around now are, yes, Mary knew, you know, and then here's a list of all the things that she knew. And really, it's taken the lyric just a little bit too literally. It's really not a song about Mary's knowledge at all, although that is an interesting subject.
Right.
It's really a meditation on the incarnation.
Yeah.
You know, it's somebody's thinking about the contrast between the helplessness of a babe in arms versus the omnipotence of God the Son.
Right.
And staggering at it, as they should. And the song is written from the perspective of a human being, which, of course, Mary was and is. You know, again, there's extra things to be parsed out there.
Right.
But it is a staggering idea. In other words, the whole idea of the hypostatic union is what that really is, the mystery of the hypostatic union, which is something that nobody understands.
Yeah.
So it's not difficult to suspect that Mary herself didn't have a full knowledge of it at that time.
Sure.
So in that sense, I'm down with the song. Mary, did you know is a rhetorical question, it seems
to
me.
Sure.
It's like asking, do you realize the full implications of what's happened here? And can anybody realize them?
Right, right.
You know.
Yeah. Well, when I wrote the FAQ, one of the things that I played around with is because it's written from an evangelical understanding of Mary, or in many cases, a kind of lack of understanding of Mary. There are questions which I suspect many an evangelical doesn't think Mary had an understanding of. You know, so was she aware that Jesus was in fact the Son of God? You can often run into evangelicals who say, "No, she didn't have a clue who Jesus was." You know.
Keep in mind, Luke chapter 1 is in their Bible, too. They know it as well as we do, if not more. Well, in other words, all of the things that she's been told and things she says herself in the Magnificat, you know, an informed evangelical will know that those are all prophecies about Messiah.
Sure, sure.
And they'll also know that an Israelite who was in a right condition with God at that time, any Israelite, should have been familiar with messianic prophecy, and you know, if they had a believing heart, would have been willing to believe all of it, of course.
Oh, sure. So, but the thing is
the sense, in other words, I think if pressed, your average evangelical, who average better than average maybe, but I've got a pretty good opinion of where many of their many of them are biblically. And their knowledge of the Bible. I think if pressed, a good many of them would come to the conclusion that Mary certainly did know that her son was the Hebrew Messiah and Israel's deliverer and the fulfillment of the OT prophecies.
Mm-hmm.
Even that he was, in some sense, the Son of God.
It took
the whole church quite a while to parse out what Son of God is, you know.
Sure, sure.
In other words, divine, yes, the divine Son of God, but I mean, the church herself, all of her greatest saints took 300 years to get to the Trinity, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't think it's an article of our Catholic faith that Mary possessed a full Athanasian Christology.
Right.
It may be that it's true, but I don't think it's an article of our faith that it's true.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, actually, is, you know, as Steve Gardonis put it, he wrote an article recently talking about the knowledge of Jesus. What did Jesus know, and when did he know it? And I think that similar questions can be asked, because Scripture itself says that, you know, Mary pondered these things in her heart, and that's the picture that we have of Mary, is somebody who ruminates in the light of faith. She right. doesn't necessarily get everything. So, you know, the story of the finding in the temple could almost have been, you know,
right.
drafted.
Well, it's just Jesus himself asked Mary, did you know?
Right, right.
He says, did you not know that I would be in my Father's house? So right. he seems to think that there was a limitation to her knowledge.
Sure, and that's how she acts. I mean, she runs back to Jerusalem because, you know, this is like every parent's nightmare, right?
Right.
It's the Home Alone nightmare, right?
Right.
We left the Son of God somewhere in Jerusalem, you know? And so they go, I thought you had him. No, I thought you had him.
That's right, yeah. Well, it's a very interesting story to ponder in this context. You know, it pretty well establishes the idea that Mary, did you know, is a valid question at times, you know.
Right, right.
It's not part of our faith that she has an omniscience about, well, many of the questions in the song ask things like, did you know that he would walk on water? Did you know that, you know, he would raise the dead and things of this
type?
Right, right. And, you know, there's no reason to think that she would know all the details of what he was going to do in advance.
We're up against the break right now, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back with Rod Bennett talking about Mary, Did You Know?
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. We're talking about Mary, Did You Know? I mentioned before in the last segment, I talked about and you're familiar with this too, of course, the evangelical fear of Mary and suspicion, particularly of the Catholic Mary. You know, the Catholics just honor Mary way too much and so forth. And so, yes, one of the things, the fact is that culture can affect, of course, the way in which you read Scripture. Nobody ever comes to Scripture without a pair of glasses on.
Right.
We all have a pair of glasses on, and that pair of glasses comes to us from our tradition. And so it affects the way you read the text and what gets in and what tends to bounce off.
Right.
And so you can have Luke chapter 1, you know, staring you in the face, and you can read all about, you know, what the angel says to Mary and the kind of information that he imparts to Mary, you know, the child that you will bear shall be called Son of the Most High God and so on and so forth.
Right, right, right.
But in some places in evangelicalism and especially in fundamentalism, all of that can get filtered out anyway, in odd ways. So, for example, when you read Mark chapter 3, there's the story of the Pharisees say that Jesus is possessed by a demon. And then Mary and the brothers and sisters of Jesus show up to take Jesus home. And the way I was taught to read that was that Mary agreed with the Pharisees. She thought Jesus was crazy too. She was trying to just, you know, basically kind of pack him off to the goofy booth because she thought that he had just kind of lost his mind. Now there's absolutely no basis for that in the text. But because shortly thereafter, Jesus says, you know, somebody says, blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that gave you suck. And Jesus says, blessed rather are those who hear the word of God and obey it. Somehow, we managed to turn that into a rebuke of Mary.
Of Mary, yeah. Yeah, that's the closest I've ever heard to it, is that Jesus was somehow taking care to make sure that the focus didn't get on to Mary.
Right, right. But yeah. but the odd thing about that reading, of course, was that that notion that for some reason Jesus feels this need to rebuke Mary, and the reason he's rebuking her in that reading was because of her lack of faith in him as the Messiah. But then, when you get over to the story of the wedding at Cana, in that reading, what I was taught was not only does Mary believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but she believes it way too much. She's like the original pushy Jewish stage mother who's like trying to shove Jesus out to, you know, impress the ladies' auxiliary. Do a miracle so everybody will think you're awesome. And then once again, as I was taught, Jesus had to rebuke her again, this time because she believed in him, but in a wrong way, and she believed in him too much. And what began to bug me as an evangelical was both of these narratives can't be true. It can't be the
case. You kind of have to pick one.
You have to pick one. And in fact, neither of them has to be true.
But they simply both
can't be true.
Right.
And so that was part of what began to bug me. And you can have those, and you do have those narratives held to, despite the fact, the very clear fact that in Luke chapter 1, Mary's been given a huge preview into who it is. It's not like who she's giving birth to has been kept a secret from her.
Right.
She knows this from the outset, and she's been pondering this all of her life. And yet, as an evangelical, I was taught that Mary didn't get it. She's always wrong. Jesus is constantly having to rebuke her. And above all, it was crucial to keep affirming one really crucial doctrine, which is Mary is a sinner just like the rest of us. In fact, she's dumber than the apostles. And Jesus always has to
chew her out. In an interesting way, this is tied in with the great apostasy that I have written about recently. The hard break between the Old and the New Testament that evangelicals insist on. So that Jesus himself is kind of a Martin Luther who had to give a hard reboot to the system, you know. That idea feeds into this, because the actual understanding of Mary is that this is the Israelite that the entire Old Testament economy has been trying to produce all along.
Exactly.
In other words, this is the kind of Israelite who, you know, when God's ready to deliver the world, there's somebody there. He finds faith on the earth. He finds somebody there who will understand what Gabriel is talking about.
Right.
Who will even hear his prophecy, the prophecy of God earlier, that a sword would pierce Mary's soul also. In other words, they're suffering for her in all of this too.
Yeah.
Who would hear all that and still say, so be it.
Yeah.
Let it be done to me as you've said.
Yes.
In other words, this is what the synagogue has been trying to produce, is the faithful Israelite who will know and understand what the angel says and will go with it.
Yes.
And so there's not a hard break. It's not a complete reboot. In other words, the system, despite all its failings, God's plan of salvation worked.
Yes.
You know, there was somebody there who was ready to receive the message when it came. And in a very striking way, that somebody is this one Jewish girl.
Right. And this
is why the church fathers make a great deal about calling her the new Eve.
Right.
That she undoes the mess that Eve got us into.
So that's why she has a pivotal role. That's why this song this is a classic sort of glass half empty, glass half full moment. From a Catholic perspective, of course, yes, the song, you know, the glass is half empty. There are flaws in the theology of Mary, did you know, granted, all that. But, you know, from an evangelical perspective, from an evangelicalism.
Teachable moment.
from an evangelicalism that taught me that Mary was just, she was always wrong, and she was always saying stupid things, and Jesus was always rebuking her and had this relationship with her like Joan Crawford's daughter had with Joan Crawford, you know?
Well, you know, all it's interesting. The song really does get a bad rap in some ways. The one verse in it that really is contrary to Catholic dogma is the verse about, did you know that your baby boy's come to make you new, that the child that you delivered will soon deliver you.
Soon deliver you, yeah.
This implies that at the time of the nativity, Mary is still a sinner awaiting redemption, which really does fly in the face of our dogma of the Immaculate Conception.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, even there, it's not so very clear, or it wasn't to people like Bonaventure and or was it Bonaventure, Bellarmine, or and Aquinas? In other words, this is the exact point at which they stumbled and balked at the Immaculate Conception.
Well, yes and no. By the High Middle Ages, no one, absolutely no one, questions that Mary is without sin. Aquinas believes that Mary is without sin as much as anybody
but
else.
The verse in the song is about the timing.
Well, the question is, how did she get that way? And so it's not, was she without sin, you know, at her birth? Yes, she was without sin at her birth. The question is, how does she get to be that way?
Right. This is what the song is asking, has her redemption been accomplished yet at this point?
Yeah, exactly.
That's why it's interesting. I mean, if even our greatest doctors could hesitate and pause a bit at this moment, then maybe it's not so ignorant that an evangelical didn't get it exactly right, who's never heard of Thomas Aquinas.
And that's exactly the point, is this is a huge step forward for evangelicals, and Catholics should welcome that. They should be grateful that there are evangelicals who, instead of reacting to Mary with fear, are reacting to Mary with reverence, which is, that's where it starts, you know, is once you start looking at Mary and her place in the divine economy, if you're open to reality, you're going to stumble into Catholic teaching, because Catholic teaching describes
reality. I absolutely think that an evangelical who's heard this song every Christmas for the last 20 years has had some time to meditate on the idea of the Mother of God.
Right. Yeah,
and the idea will not be completely foreign and alien to them when we get around to discussing it with them.
Yeah, and so it's a kind of a pre-evangelization moment. It's a song that helps prepare evangelicals for the Marian dimension of our faith. And you know, once you start contemplating the Marian dimension of our faith, of course, the thing about Mary is that the thing is never really about Mary. That the Marian dimension of our faith is really about who Jesus is, and therefore about who we are. And once you start to get that, as happened for me, there's a kind of an avalanche that can happen in your thought where you're going, wait a minute, if that's true, then everything else that the Catholic Church has to say about Mary all of a sudden clicks into place. You can feel the tumblers turning over, and you go,
right,
oh, wow, you know.
I never saw that before.
Yeah. So it's a remarkable thing, and it's a hopeful thing.
I think so, too.
Not good Catholic theology, but a genuinely positive step forward for evangelical Catholic relations. Rod Bennett, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back tomorrow with Reverend Mr. Stephen Gradonis. We'll see you then. Thank you, Rod.
It's always fun.
And thank you, Danny Head, for being our producer today. Bye-bye.
So long, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.